Hey there, welcome to another episode of the Dead Frog Podcast. I'm your host, Joe Felix. Today I am not joined by Allie Kloster, but she will be back soon. We are a podcast dedicated to analyzing, dissecting, understanding the art of stand-up comedy. Today we will be discussing Baron Vaughn's appearance on the Craig Ferguson show, which I think is also his late night with Craig Ferguson at the time. And with me today to discuss Baron Vaughn's set is Andy C. Ryder. He is the co-runner of the super amazing Insta live stream with Matt Robinson, and also he co-runs Best Friend Comedy with Sammy Sutkar and Chris Jason. Andy, did I say those names correctly?
Chris Jason, yes. Sammy Sutkar.
Sammy Sutkar, by the way, you're also a South Carolina native.
Yeah, from Charleston originally.
Charleston. Oh, that's there are a few chews that come from that region, right?
Few what?
Chews.
Chews?
Yeah, from Charleston.
Oh, Charleston Chews. Yeah. I always forget about that for some reason. I'm always like, oh, yeah, I guess that is a thing that's happening there. Yeah, we got that.
Yeah, you're probably tired of that, and you're like, I'm just going to willfully forget it.
It was weird because I discovered it as a kid, because I would see ads for it anywhere, but I could not find them in Charleston anywhere.
Oh, yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, I'm not sure if they're South Carolina related or if there's something else and they just happen to be called Charleston. And we're like, oh.
That's like the opposite of, do you know of Panera Bread? Do you know that in St. Louis?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we got this.
Oh, for listeners, it's called, in St. Louis, I think it's called the St. Louis Bread Company.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay, so see, that's like I have a hard time calling Carl's Jr. Carl's Jr. because we don't call them Carl's Jr. on the East Coast. We call them Hardee's.
Yeah, definitely.
So I'm like, you guys go to Hardee's? They're like, what? I'm like, Carl's Jr.?
Yeah, I think over here on the West Coast, it was more like, you know, Latinos are very likely to name their children after themselves. So you have, you know, it's a junior. So they're like, all right, Carl's is enough, like Carlos, which is a hint at the Latin demographic, and then the junior part also is more aggressively targeting the Latin demographic.
Oh, so, man.
No, I have no idea, but that's what I'm
about. Yeah, that's possible, though, you know?
I hope that's true. I hope I got it right, and I get a cease and desist, given that I uncovered this whole marketing campaign. So, Andy, dude, how are the shows going right now?
The shows? I mean, like, as far as, like, doing stand-up shows, those aren't really happening. I'm not, like, actively pursuing Zoom shows. I've gotten asked to do a couple, and I've done a couple, and they're fine. But it's just, like, I know everybody said this, but, like, they're not the same, and it feels weird to do them, you know? Like, I'm always grateful for when I get offered one, but I'm not, like, I don't know. I'm not like, I'm just like, you know, I'm just going to keep doing other stuff. I'm not going to like start hitting people up to do all the Zoom shows, you know?
Oh yeah. I definitely understand that. And I don't think it's being ungrateful at all. It really just is a different ambiance, and it's not as.
Yeah. I just don't want to be one of those guys. Cause I remember when like quarantine first hit, there was like a lot of like bigger comics were like, Zoom shows are stupid. I'm never going to do one, blah, blah, blah. And then like 2 months in, like I saw all those people on Zoom shows. I was like, see, why are you going to make fun of people for doing Zoom shows? If they want to do Zoom shows, let them do Zoom shows. I have friends who do like multiple Zoom shows all the time. And I'm never like, guys, what are you doing with your time? I'm like, hey, if they like it, they like it. I'm not going to be like, don't do that.
Yeah, definitely. And I also feel like if you're someone who like likes comedy and you're casually into it, you know, I feel like, let's say you're like middle age or you're kind of, you have some sort of social anxiety. I think it's uncomfortable to actually go visit a comedy club.
Mm-hmm.
So this is one way to maybe cater to those sort of people.
Totally. Yeah. There's people who have no idea that comedy clubs exist or like how they work or whatever. And that like, I've actually gotten paid more from doing Zoom shows than I ever have from like live stand up.
Oh, congrats. So, yeah.
I'm like, that's pretty cool. I didn't realize this was a possibility, but that's nice.
Yeah. It's nice to get the, you know, get your hand in the bucket. Everyone's.
Yeah.
So, you're originally from South Carolina. Why did you make the move? Or were you doing comedy over there too?
Yeah, I was doing comedy in Charleston for like a number of years. And like at the time, like there was like a, like a lot of people were leaving Charleston to go do stand-up other places, like in New York and LA and Chicago, and like just do comedy in general. Like some people were doing improv, some people were doing sketch, but they all moved away. And I was like, I got to be part of that because I want to do more of this. And like Charleston, you can do stand-up like once or twice a week, maybe. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to get really good at it. So I was like, I need to go somewhere you can do it way more often. And I want to be able to do this for like a living of some sort. Like I want to make some money off of this. That'd be kind of cool, you know?
Yeah.
So I can at least go somewhere where there, at least there's a possibility of doing it. That being said, I have two friends. One of them moved to Nashville and he's been on like late night shows, you know, like doing stand up.
Very cool. Yeah.
And then, another one, Jeremy McClellan, got JFL about a year into me being out here, but still living in Charleston. He got JFL as one of the new faces, unrep.
Yeah. Oh, good for him. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm like, okay, well, it doesn't necessarily matter, but at the same time, like, I was like, that's still cool, but I still wanted to be in LA because, like, in Charleston, it was like, it would be weird to be like, hey, guys, let's go somewhere else to do comedy, like maybe an hour away, hour and a half away. And people would just be like, maybe, I don't know. And I'm like, okay, well, I just want to do it more than once a week if possible. Is that a thing we can do?
How long were you doing it over there and what year did you move over here?
I was doing it there for about 6 or so years. Okay. So I was there for about 6 years and then I moved here in 2016.
Oh, okay. That's fairly recent. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I've only been here for about 4 years now.
Cool. How are you liking, are you getting the amount of stage time that you moved here for?
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's kind of weird actually. Cause like, I'm a big like goal setter guy as far as like what I want to be able to accomplish and stuff, you know?
Yeah.
So like, when I first moved out here, one of my big things was like, I want to do San Francisco Sketch Fest. Like, cause that to me was like one of the big festivals, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I got to do that festival like about a year or so ago. And so I was like, whoa, this is awesome. So I hit that goal. And then like, I was like, I just want to do a bunch of shows with like, and just be on shows with like other cool comics that like either I look up to or I enjoy being around. And I've gotten to do that. And that's been really awesome. And now it's like, okay, but now what? Like as far as comedy, because like I've decided I don't want to tour because I did like one nighters for a little bit. And I was like, I don't like this so much. Like being in my hotel room alone is not where it's at for me, you know?
Yeah. Okay. So then how'd you pivot from that?
So like for me, like now I'm just kind of pursuing like writing gigs. I'm trying to get into that, like writing for TV and stuff, you know?
Yeah, definitely.
So that's kind of where I'm at now.
But you want to do late night or do you want to do, you want to be staffed somewhere on a sitcom?
Yeah, I think I want to be staffed on a sitcom somewhere. If I got a gig writing for late night, that'd be cool. But it's like, I feel like writing for late night is so hard because a lot of it is very political and I'm not that guy.
Like, yeah, okay.
I'm always like a guy who, like, I'm not a super opinionated person because I tend to try to look at both sides of an argument before I like really put my foot down in one camp or the other. And I feel like if you're going to be a political type comic, you have to have a strong opinion one way or the other. And you have to be just like, regardless, I'm going to go this way all the way, you know?
Oh, actually, I'm sorry to
push
back on that, but I've taken a few late night writing classes and I don't think you need to do that at all.
Oh, really? Okay.
Well, yeah. One, because there are topics in the monologue jokes that are not political.
Right.
And then, I mean, they're just like, you know, topical events. And then you can do topical humor. And I know that several times, you know, if you want to do hit a punchline that's like on either side or someone that's opposite of your, actually on the same side of your political beliefs, you can still do that. Mm-hmm. And there are a bunch of like Obama jokes, even by Jimmy Kimmel, someone who I think supported Obama. I think you're putting some boundaries on yourself, and you know, as someone who like who writes jokes, you know, like yourself.
Yeah.
I mean, you should go for it, man. Don't sell yourself short. You
know? Yeah, I had another friend get on my case because they had that Colbert packet submission recently.
Yes.
And they were like, "You didn't submit anything." I was like, no, they're like, but you knew about it. I was like, I know, I told you about it. And they're like, but you didn't do it. And I was like, I'm sorry, I don't know. All I know is Colbert's from Charleston, and that's pretty cool. But like, I don't know what else to do other than that. Like, I don't really know his show that well. So I don't know. But yeah. They said, listen, from now on, any opportunities you get, you need to take the chance. I'm like, all right, fine. I will do that.
You should have some. Yeah, dude. Because if you're not doing it, somebody else will be doing it. It's tough, but you're going to – I think the late-night writing muscle is a little different than the stand-up muscle.
Oh, totally. Yeah. You have to learn how to write somebody else's voice, and it's a weird thing, I think. Like, I've gotten to read friends' packets, and it's so weird to see that compared to their actual voice. I'm like, whoa, how did you do that? Like, you just turned your voice off? What happened there?
So, anybody listening, I discourage you from – submitting packets because, you know, you're in direct competition with me, but at the same time, you know,
sure,
please go ahead and do it. Like, just don't stop yourself. It takes years to be a good joke writer.
Oh, totally. And also, like, you don't know exactly what's going to happen either. Like, you never know exactly what's I was listening to an interview with this guy who wrote for Fallon for like a year, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And like, he could not get anything on to save his life because all of his stuff was like really weird and dark. But he's like, but that's the stuff you was in my packet. It's not like I tried to hide that from you guys. Like, that's what I write, and that's what you hired me for.
So yeah.
He said he got like two or three sketches on air, and they always bombed because they were like just kind of odd sketches.
Yeah, that's also what I've heard with. For sitcoms, you know, you should write in your voice, you know, mm-hmm. listen to what they're asking for, but write in your voice, because then, you know, if you're like the sci-fi guy and you're doing a show that doesn't have anything to do with sci-fi, but they kind of need that.
Yeah.
And you're still able to like understand the voice of the characters. Like who I'm not going to like, you know, as a showrunner, I'm not going to hire you if your voice is exactly like mine. Right. I'm already doing that.
Yeah, exactly. You want to have, yeah, you want to have like an abundance of different voices so you can get like a better, more diverse show kind of going on.
I guess the analogy, right? I think the perfect analogy, and nobody could ever push back on this, is it's that it's like Power Rangers, right? They're all different colors, right? They all mm-hmm. have a different, damn it. What are those things called? What are those? Zords? Are they called Zords?
They're robots?
Yeah.
Yeah, Zords. Mm-hmm.
And then, but Zordon's called Zordon? Okay.
But then they had like Megazord, right?
Yeah. All right. Well, yeah. They're all Power Rangers, right? But they all have a different flavor, and each flavor is there's a very racial coloring system there. But I'm losing the point.
No.
You remember that? You remember the first generation?
Yeah, that's the only generation I actually understand, because that's the first time I started watching it, and I was like, oh, what's happening here? But then I would like miss multiple episodes and never like be able to catch up what's going on with the storyline, you know?
Yeah. Really?
Yeah.
Damn.
Somebody had to point out to me that like all the fighting scenes were like taken from the original Japanese show.
Yeah, they were. Yeah, definitely.
In the original Japanese show, the yellow Power Ranger was not Trini. It was a guy.
It was a guy, yeah.
So like if you watch the fight scene, you're like, oh, that's weird. She became a dude at some point. She lost her skirt and now she's like just wearing pants and she's a dude, I guess.
Yeah. I knew that, but I didn't notice that she loses the skirt. Yeah.
Yeah, it's such a weird thing. It's like, oh, okay.
I did like, yeah, the color association, because, you know, the leader was in red, depicting like a redneck, depicting someone who like peaks in high school, right? Like that's mm-hmm. the last leadership position he's gonna have.
Right.
Then yeah, there's like the blue collar worker, right? What's his name? Billy, who was like blue collar worker. He's, you know, doing data entry.
Right.
Black guy was in a black suit. Asian woman was in a yellow thing. The girl was in a pink.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the other woman. Yeah.
I was saying.
Yeah.
It's hard to tell with Trini.
But yeah, dude. Earlier I was talking about joke writing. So I do have to ask you, you know, since you're on the show.
Sure.
What was your first time, like, writing a joke or performing anything at all?
My first time performing was at Tin Roof, which is, like, this was like a very popular comedy place in Charleston. Like it was a bar, really cool bar in West Ashley, and we would all go there. But like my friend just told me like, hey, our friend Jason runs a mic there and we should go do that. And I was like, okay. And it was like once a month. So I think my first joke was probably something about like, what was it? I think it was about like wanting to be Superman. It's weird. Like I actually have like a set from like a month after that, like recorded on YouTube right now that I could find. I think it's something to do with wanting to be Superman or no, wanting to be Spider-Man, I guess. My mom would like tell me like, hey, if you take a nap, you'll be strong like Spider-Man. I was like, which made a lot of sense because we lived next to a radioactive waste treatment plant and a lot of spiders. So that was a good chance. Yeah. But yeah, I think that was like one of the first jokes I wrote.
Yeah. Okay. So when you went to the Tin Roof, how many minutes were you supposed to be doing?
Like five. I had to do 5 minutes. And also I wasn't told until like right before the show started that like, hey, if you're it's your first time, you're going first. So
wow.
My friend forgot to inform me of that. So I was like, oh boy. Okay. So I had to go first. And they would like pack the place. It was like there was like 40 or 60 people in there.
That's a good turnout.
Yeah, it was a good turn. Like this was like really fun. This was like right when like I feel like Charleston stand-up was at its strongest as far as like turnouts and stuff like that for mics and stuff.
Yeah.
And they had like free Little Caesars pizza. It was called Little Caesars Palace, and then we got a cease and desist from the actual Caesars Palace.
Somehow what?
They found out they sent us a cease and desist.
Damn, that's unbelievable. Oh, that's good. Well, I mean, that's good. Do you feel like, although it was small and like less frequent, do you feel like it was a, I guess, supportive scene?
Oh yeah, totally. I mean, there were so many like good comics that hung out there. Like, I mean, that went up there and stuff like that. Like the guys who were on late night and did JFL, like they were there too, you know, at the same mic. And so like, I felt like I always feel like a good mic is like one where you're not comparing yourself to the comics out of jealousy, but you're comparing them to see like how high they're setting the bar. And
yeah.
Trying to like get over that bar, like you're trying to be just as good or better than that bar if possible.
Yeah, it's definitely a good mindset that I think people should take notes on that.
Yeah, I think that's like I don't know, some people like it's kind of weird in the LA comedy scene sometimes because there's definitely people who are like, no, just ignore everybody else, just keep doing what you're doing and don't worry about anything. I was like, well, I can see the good points to that, but if you're just ignoring everything else around you and you're not like, what is this guy doing? What is this woman doing? You know, how can I get better? If you don't have any like body to look up to, then it's like, what are you aiming for then? You know, like, how are you going to get better if you don't have anything to like, you know, work towards, you know?
I think it's funny, you know, not to discourage anyone, but I think it's funny when comics will go to the same mics and just try to impress those people.
Yeah.
And it's like, why are you limiting yourself so much? Yeah. I mean, it's good for like other people, right? Who are more open to doing stuff because then, you know, you have less of competition. But
yeah, in Charleston, we used to have a big stand-up competition where there was like a prelim, semifinals, and finals. And there was like four or five rounds of prelims, and there was two semifinals and a final. But like the big win at the end was like, if you got in the top three spots, you would either get to open for like one of the bigger comics they flew in for the Charleston Comedy Festival. So it'd be like somebody like Todd Barry, you'd get to open for them.
Damn.
You know, at like awesome. Yeah, Charleston yeah. Music Hall, which seats like easily, I don't know, maybe 600 people or something like that, you know? So you get to open for them, or you get your own show at Charleston Comedy Festival with the two other winners and you get paid.
Like that's huge.
You get a percentage of the door, you know?
That's amazing. Yeah.
So that was like awesome. And like, I used to love doing those. Like, don't get me wrong. If I lost, like, man, it hurts so bad. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, like, I wasn't like mad at the people who were winning. Like, I was like, oh no, screw that. Like, this is cool. Like, I want to be just as good as these guys, if not better, and beat them. And so, like, I'm not going to get mad, but, like, some people couldn't handle it very well. Like, they just got very upset, and they were just like, I guess nobody thinks I'm funny. I was like, no, people think you're funny. It doesn't matter. You're performing in front of 140 people at one of the prelims. So you're already getting a good guidance as far as like your humor goes anyways. And then if you get in the top five, you get to go to the semifinal, and then you get like a you know, you're with, you get another minute of time to do your stuff and really figure out your set. And I just liked all of that stuff. Like, I like competition, and not in like the bad way where I want to be a jerk to people, but just in the way where I'm like, all right, cool. Like, this is where I stand, and like, this is like, I need to get better. And like, what is that encourages me in a lot of ways, I feel like. But I'm not going to be like, that's for everybody. Everybody should do that. That's just how I kind of look at things sometimes.
Yeah, it is sort of strange because, I mean, people who are already in that mentality, you know, they won't go far unless they really, really lean into it. And they're like, you know, screw everybody else, I'm in it for myself. Then they become like sort of conniving and guile. And you see them. Yeah, some people actually make it, you know. Some people are jerks and they. They make it, but at the same time, it's like, you know, if you can't deal with that criticism, maybe don't be a stand-up in that way. Like, maybe do it casually. I don't know how to address that, but there are people who I know, like, it's like, hey, I think you're better suited for something else, you know?
Yeah, maybe.
Maybe make a lateral move. Write something, produce something. You know, there's so many ways. Even just becoming a booker on a show is possible. Yeah.
I think so. I think you can do all of those things and more. And like, some of the people who like weren't into the competition, like, they're still doing fine. And like, I'm still friends with them. Like, they weren't like bad people or whatever. It's just a difference in mindset, I think, sometimes.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, well, like, whatever, you know. But like, I mean, at the same time, like, when you go to a mic, like, are you just like, I'll just do my jokes and, you know, and it's just a weird thing. Because I'm listening to other people's jokes. I'm like, oh man, I wish I'd written that. Like, that's great. You know? Or I'm like, oh, I need to do better than this. Like, I need to like, I just need to do better, you know?
Yeah. And both of those are a form of inspiration.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. Andy, I think, we're at that moment where we've got to set up the clip.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. We're going to take a break. So once again, this is Baron Vaughn on Craig Ferguson. Listeners, please forgive me, but the only recording I can find of the set has a few like notifications about halfway through. It's slightly distracting, but I don't really think so. But yeah, please stick around and listen to a word from our sponsors.
Thank you very much. Hello, audience. I feel fantastic tonight because not only am I perfectly pulling off this look, which I call a middle school bus driver and his night off, but also I'm wearing my combination under these clothes, which is cocoa butter and Old Spice. That's right, ladies, cocoa butter and Old Spice, or as I like to call it, rugged dessert, because that's the only way to describe the scent. Like, when I walk past you and you can't help but go, why does it smell like chocolate chip cookies just bench pressed 250 in here? That's me. And the ladies love rugged dessert, especially during the summertime, because it gets a little hotter. That's when I activate. Like, I start to glisten, the pheromones come off me, and the ladies come at me so hungry. I can't escape the ladies. I go to the left, ladies. I go to the right, ladies. I'm trying to sleep, and ladies are all up in my face. Ladies, ladies, ladies all over the place. Wait, did I say ladies? I mean mosquitoes. Mosquitoes all over the place. Only female mosquitoes bite. So in that sense, I'm a chick magnet. Someone told me I get bit up a lot because I have sweet blood, and I am changing my name to that. From the age of 70 on, that's when they call myself Sweet Blood Nebuchadnezzar. Nice to meet you, Mr. President. May I present the blues? And then also, I feel like there's some insect racism going on. Like, I feel like mosquitoes see me and they're like, a black man, he must have high blood sugar. I've been reading medical reports. Come back here, Kool-Aid veins. Now, there's this new term going around called black nerd, and I don't exactly know how I feel about it, especially because I'm supposed to be one. But I've never called myself a nerd or referred to myself as a nerd because I lack the commitment I think it takes to be a nerd. You know, like, I love nerd culture, but I'm not in love with nerd culture, you know? Like, I like comic books and video games, but not as a lifestyle. Like, the only thing I've ever been able to really get into, like, as an activity, like, as a hobby, though, is naps. Where are the trading cards for naps? Because I am a sleep nerd. It's also called depression. Thank you. I was talking to a Caucasian friend the other day about black nerds, and he's like, well, if it's new, like, who invented it? Who's the first black nerd? Was it like Steve Urkel? And I was like, how about Frederick Douglass, okay? Nothing's nerdier than freedom. And how dare you throw out Urkel as an actual option? That's a fictional character, man. Here are some non-fiction options I would have accepted. Booker T. Washington, W.E.B. Du Bois, Medgar Evers, Malcolm X, Martin Luther King Jr. You know, the names you recognize from history class in February. Why? Because before black nerd, it was called black leader. Can you dig it? And then at some point in the 80s, it became uncool for black people to read. I'm not going to point fingers, but if I were to, I'd point at crack and Reagan. And so pursuing knowledge became like a nerdy thing. It became a mockery. What is this nerd doing? Reading? What are you reading, nerd? The Constitution? This nerd wants to understand this country as a concept envisioned by our forefathers and see if there's a gap between that and how it is practiced by our elected officials. That way, he can join the system and work within it to make this country better for the citizens of it and also the citizens of other countries, since we are a world power. Nerd! Thank you. And that child ran home to his mom saying, they're making fun of me. And then she said, don't you worry about that, Barack. Thank you very much.
Whoa, Andy.
Yo.
What a great set.
That was such a good set. So good.
Dude, I can't believe we both just heard that right now. And we were laughing for such a long time that we had to pause.
I had to pause it a few times. You were like, can we go now? I was like, no. Stop for a minute here.
Yeah, because it was just that funny. It was, yeah.
It's such a good set.
Why the set? Why Baron Vaughn?
Like, did you ever go to or listen to Put Your Hands Together?
Yes.
I used to listen to that all the time when I was living in Charleston. And, like, Baron Vaughn, I think, guest hosted a few times. I was like, man, I love this guy. Who is this guy? Like, I started doing more and more research on him. That's when I found this late night set. And it feels like such a tight set. Like, he circles back around to the end and everything is just, like, flowing together, even though they're kind of a variety of topics, kind of like the Kirk Fox one you did with Lupe about a week or two ago. There's a lot of different topics, but he makes them like just seamless as far as like them fitting together and everything, you know.
Oh, he has very good transitions. Yeah.
Yeah, and there's so much going on here. Like I'm totally guilty of this, but I feel like as stand-up comics, like we forget that we're performers. Like we just want to be joke machines.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
Say jokes and be like, that's enough. But then, like, Baron Vaughn is, like, an all-out performer. And I know that he's like, a Shakespearean-trained actor. So, yeah, that's going to help me out a little bit.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, he's, like, a big Shakespearean-trained actor guy. Like, he went to, like, a really good theater school. And then I think around that time is when he got into stand-up.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting. Damn. Yes. Those actors, man, they have the stage presence. And it's just always like them moving into stand-up is really just about writing material at that point. Because they just instinctually know how to, like, draw out a joke. They know the pacing. They know how, like, when to do act-outs. It's just writing. Yeah, so do you want to get into the opening here?
Sure, let's do it.
A very positive start, right? He's happy to be there. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which he should be as a comic. unless your whole character is like, I'm a miserable, you know, jerk. Yeah. Yeah, he says, you know, make fun of his appearance, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Classic.
Which I do like the appearance, because you'll later find the juxtaposition that he's making.
Yeah.
Of like, how do you put this? When he, sorry to skip so far in advance, but when he goes, you know, Mr. President, I present to you the blues.
Yeah, exactly.
Like the way that, you know, African Americans had to, not had to dress, but they dressed in the early 1900s, where it's like, I need to present the semblance of like, of a sort of civility that white people won't harass me for.
You know, mm-hmm. We can do that.
And I see it in that way, where he's like, he's almost like making a commentary on like the chucking and jiving, mm-hmm. and the attire that one would wear is kind of like that, like the attire of someone who's in a civil servant sort of position.
I could see that, yeah.
Yeah.
I felt like, and this is me, I was like, I just feel like he wanted to dress nice, but yeah, it could also be I could see how those two flow together though too.
Like, oh, I mean, for an actor, I mean, I would find the garb to be like even more important.
You know? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he points out that he looks like a middle school bus driver on his night off. Then, you know, he's like, okay, this is going to be about me. So the way that I introduce this next thing about wearing cocoa butter and Old Spice.
Right? Yeah.
It's a very good setup to a punchline and a few tags.
Right. Because he says, I like to wear it in the summer because that's when I activate.
Yeah, that's when which is like both, I think, a reference to like how deodorant is marketed to you, right? It's mm-hmm. like, you know, once you start to sweat, our product will commence. It's time for these chemicals to begin anew. Defend you, right? It's like, I don't know. So I think, and also it's just funny to say that it activates.
Yeah, exactly. Well, like it's like he's doing that classic you know, like make fun of yourself for the audience, like the way they're like more on board with you a little bit, like they're like, okay, whatever this guy's gonna say next, like we're already on board with him, because he obviously, you know, can take a joke as well, you know, about himself.
Yeah. And it's also, he immediately talks about, because he mentions a few stereotypes throughout his set.
Mm-hmm.
And the first one is like the use of cocoa butter.
Yeah.
So I think that's cool. It's a very positive spin on grasping onto a stereotype.
Yeah, I think so. Like, it's interesting you say all this, because I thought about it, you know, and it is there, but like now that I'm thinking about it more, like he co-hosts that show, The New Negroes,
mm-hmm.
with Open Mike Eagle.
Yeah.
And like what that show was all about was like showing the diversity of black comedy and stuff like that. And, you know, not letting it just be like, we just have Def Jam comics. Like, no, we have comics of all types. It's like, we do have Def Jam comics though, but we also have other comics as well that do like eccentric alternative stuff, and we have other comics that deal with like socio-political issues, and we have other comics like this too, you know. And it's like, it's such an interesting thing for him to see that now and then like at the time, like I think when I first heard this, he might have been like one of the few black comics I was aware of at the time, you know.
Okay.
And so like, and I know that, I can't remember who it was, maybe it might have been Yashir Lester, pointed out that like Comedy Central and some of the other ones only tend to go after like comics that might be more appealing to a white audience,
mm-hmm.
than like, because he's like there's plenty of black comics, he's like and I'm referring to myself in this group of comics that you tend to look at because we're more appealing because our voice is a lighter touch maybe to white people or something like that. Kind of went way off topic there, but
wait, me?
No, me. I did.
Okay. No, yeah, I mean, yeah, like, yeah. Were you referring to that my voice is more appealing to white people?
No. He was talking about like black comics in general. Like, he was talking about black comics that Comedy Central tends to, like, court, I guess, and have them on shows and stuff like that.
Yeah. But, yeah, definitely with that project, The New Negroes, with Open Mike Eagle, he was able to use that to, like, open up the door for more black comics, which mm-hmm. is like fantastic. I I think someone I know, I think Ellington wrote for that.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, I do like. To go back to, let's go back to this thing here, because I'm a little flustered because my little brother keeps starting to talk.
About Baron Vaughn, or just in general.
I wish he just had like trivia on tap. Yeah. But yeah, you're absolutely right. Well, thank you for yes-anding my commentary on the cocoa butter thing.
Yeah.
He does the few tags after he calls it rugged dessert. You know, it smells like chocolate. I mean, how else would you describe that smell of what it feels like when a chocolate chip cookies bench 250? Right? And he goes into this how late. This is really good. This quick little act out, or not act out, but this quick little bit about how the ladies just won't leave him alone.
Yes.
And you're like, is this guy for real? Is he really talking about like these gals, like just absolutely loving him, not leaving him alone, like in the summer, like day and night? And then it's good. Hey, then you're the reveal that it's mosquitoes.
Ladies, I turn to the right. Ladies, 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 ladies. Such a good thing. And like, you know, it's funny about that part where he's doing that motion left and right on that part about the ladies, you know?
Yeah.
I was listening to an interview with him and Jackie Cation, and they were talking about how like, Shakespearean actors are like trained to basically do motions that have to do kind of with the story, but kind of are also supposed to take your eyes off what they're talking about. So it's like more of a hit whenever you do finally come back to what they're saying.
Kind of. So it's even more helpful in the misdirection.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, damn, dude. Thanks for coming in prepared.
No. I just thought that's just always stuck in my head a little bit, because it's like, what? I kind of understand it, but I kind of don't, you know? Like, I'm not the best performer.
I'm glad you bring that up. That's really important, because I recently saw Ralphie May. I mean, R.I.P., you know, Ralphie May, but I was watching.
Like, where? On the street? Or what? What's he up to?
I was watching a set where he talks about like an audience member who was like homophobic, and then he goes off to talk about like what it like wrangling calves or something, right? Uh-huh. And he describes that whole process, and you've forgotten that he's mentioned this homophobic woman.
Yeah.
And after explaining what it's like how you wrangle a calf, he goes, "Yeah, that's what I did to that woman." So yeah, you're right. That's absolutely. Like really great insight on that.
Thanks. Yeah.
After that, he it's a very good lead into the mosquito thing, right? Mm-hmm. So he starts talking about how mosquitoes usually come at, you know, they're female, so he's technically a chick magnet, right?
Yeah.
But then he's already set up the fact that he's getting bit a lot. Right. And and they're like, you know, you must have sweet blood, which that's such a funny just concept to begin with. Right. And he might even change his name to Sweet Blood, like when he turns 70, like to like these very like kind of funny and folksy names that we take on as when we get older. Right. Like Pops and Gam Gam and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Sweet Blood. You know, that sounds a lot better.
What was funny is whenever he said the sweet blood thing, I later found out I was wrong, but I immediately assumed he was from the South, because like I used to get bit up by mosquitoes all the time. Yeah. And my family was just like, oh, it's because you have sweet blood. And I was like, what? Well, get it out of me, because I don't want this.
Yeah.
So I assumed he was from the South. He's not. He's from like Las Vegas.
Yeah, I think it's like O positive or O blood types get. No, I don't know what it is, but yeah, you can be sort of like what genetically predisposed to getting, attracting mosquitoes more. So, you know, maybe it's a comic thing, dude. Maybe you, me, Baron Vaughn, we're all on equal footing. Yeah,
we should have a support group about this. You know, we'll just talk about it.
Yeah, I mean, Baron, if you're listening, you're welcome to chime in.
Of course, please do.
Then he talks about, he does a little act out. Yeah, Mr. President, may I present the blues?
Yeah.
Which is, I think that's a joke for him and just a few people to understand like that sort of. I don't think anybody who's born, sorry, I don't mean to be that guy, but I don't think anyone who's born after like the year 2000 would understand anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you never know. Like John Mulaney did a big Clinton, Bill Clinton bit with The Fugitive. And maybe it's his act out that got people on board with that, but I don't know. But yeah, it's weird what people do know about and what they don't know about prior to 2000, you know?
Yeah, I'm like, you know, I'll watch Blackish with my younger brother who's 8 right now, and I'm like, yeah. Oh, I gotta explain these references that I get, and I'm like, ugh, like, is it even worthwhile to teach them all these things?
Yeah.
And like, how do you set up a curriculum, you know, for pop culture? Anyways.
I don't know. It's weird to me whenever I see like 15-year-olds wearing Nirvana t-shirts. I'm like, what's happening, man? Why are you wearing that? Do you know who they are?
Well, yeah. I believe that they know who they are. Because I feel like, you know, around 11, 12, 13, that's when you start to learn about music. And that's when you're like, you're really enthused by any sort of band. Like, I think maybe if they were wearing like a Tool t-shirt.
Yeah.
I think that would be interesting.
That would be cool though.
Yeah, Nirvana's very, you know, they became mainstream.
That's true. Yeah, I always forget about that. I always think about like Teen Spirit. Teen Spirit. I'm like, yeah, that song. And then I just assume when a band dies, like they don't get radio play anymore. Like if I saw a kid wearing a Foo Fighter shirt, I would be more understanding of that because they're still around versus a Nirvana shirt. I'm like, what?
Oh, I gotta tell you, my friend, K-Rock will always play Nirvana.
Didn't they just become like a pop hip-hop station?
K-Rock?
Yeah, they said they were changing their format to be more pop and hip-hop friendly or something like that.
You're kidding me.
That's what I've been told. That's what I read on, you know.
I'm gonna look that up after this. I'm very upset.
Well,
thanks for being the bearer. Yeah, but you know, he does act out of a mosquito being like, come back, you know, or he's done his research.
Right? Yeah.
Like African Americans have what was it? Just higher blood sugar.
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's just like, come back, Kool-Aid veins.
Kool-Aid veins. That was such a good like just bit right there, just like saying Kool-Aid, calling somebody Kool-Aid veins is so funny to me.
Which I think is another very quick acknowledgement of the stereotype.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then he talks about loving nerd culture, but not being in love with nerd culture. Right.
Right.
I think that's cool. That's a good entry. And I like how he's able to maneuver this next joke about naps into it and then coming back. Because, you know, not to speak of, I mean, I hope this isn't a, well, you know, whatever. I know Louis C.K. is someone that people don't really like to talk about.
Yeah.
Currently, but he was really good at doing this thing where he'd set up a joke, he'd do an aside, and these asides could even like last, you know, 10 minutes, and then he'd just come back to the original joke that he started to set up.
Yeah.
And just continue. Here, Baron does that.
Yeah, I feel like that's a skill set you have to learn from doing like longer sets, you know? Like, we do 3 and 5 minute sets, and then like, so we're not going to have the time to figure out how to do a long aside and then bring it back to the original point, you know?
Yeah, that's exactly it. You know, I think Jeff Wattenhofer from, who is a like longtime stand-up comedian in Los Angeles,
mm-hmm.
He constantly talks about the small amount of stage time that comics in LA have and like how our sets are really shaped by the amount of time that we have. And he's like the host of Exit Strategy, another podcast. It's brilliant. I would really recommend it.
Okay.
Yeah. So, you know, free plug for him for all of my, you know, he'll get all 5 of my listeners.
Way to go, Jeff.
Yeah. Freaking Jeff, dude. Then, yeah. So he sets up the loving naps, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Right. Which I did not associate naps with being a nerd, but I did associate it with like being a weeb.
Like, really?
Like a weeaboo, right? So I was like, I guess that's enough of a connection. But yeah, do you know about like nerds being nappy?
No, I felt like that was just like a thing that he was saying he was really into. Cause like, I think this is like right around the time that people just started using nerd like about themselves. Like, I think around this time, like Marvel movies had just become a big thing. And as a result, like people were just going around calling themselves nerds. Like, they're, oh, I'm such a nerd. I went to go see Iron Man in theaters. And people were like, that's just going to see a movie.
Oh, like you being, oh, that. He means it like in, as an enthusiast.
Yeah, like he's a big enthusiast of naps. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, he's a real sleep nerd.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I remember there was like an American Ninja Warrior where like one of the contestants was like, he was like, I'm the nap ninja. And I was like, no, don't do this.
Yeah. But like people love that on like, yeah. You know, when they producers are like, you know, he has a personality, but a personality that people can relate to, you know, people who kind of suck to begin with.
Yeah.
But yeah. But that is funny to call on national television and be like, I'm a nap ninja.
Yeah, he would fake like taking naps in between obstacles too. I was like, hey, dude, we get it. You're good. Keep moving, please.
Oh, yeah. He was hamming it up, huh?
Yeah, he was committing to the bit, which I was like, way to go, dude.
Oh,
but
yeah.
Also, keep it moving.
All right, then I changed my view on this guy. You're right. He is committing to the bit. Then he talks to his Caucasian friends, which like when – here's what I've noticed. When I think white audiences like being poked at for being white sometimes.
Sure.
And that gets a laugh. So the fact that he calls his Caucasian friend a Caucasian friend, like he others his Caucasian friend by calling him that gets a laugh, right?
Yeah.
Especially, and also like just using multisyllabic words in comedy will get you somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
I don't suggest going out and getting a thesaurus and just, you know.
Let's not Dennis Miller this up, okay?
Yeah, exactly.
I used to watch Dennis Miller, like his old stuff from like the early 90s and like think it was like really funny, but there was definitely times where I was like, I have no idea what you're talking about right now, man. I feel like it's just the rhythm of what you're saying that's really making me laugh.
Yeah, you're right. But Baron Vaughn is not doing that. He's doing it just enough. He sprinkles this in for comedic effect. He's talking about black nerds, right?
Yeah.
And his friend brings up, who? Steve Urkel?
That's such a good joke there, I feel like. Yeah.
No, it's like, you know, Frederick Douglass, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which you're like, yeah, I guess he was. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that's what we call just educated people. You know, it's like nerds. But
yeah, like it's kind of weird how that's kind of turned around a little bit, because you think about like, oh God, what's the name of the movie? The four black mathematicians who helped with the rocket.
Hidden Figures.
Hidden Figures, yeah. I was about to call it Hidden Fences, and I remember that's the name of a popular black play in New York that makes fun of people who can't get Hidden Figures and the Fences movie mixed up.
Oh, and it's called, what would you call it, Hidden Fences?
There's a play called Hidden Fences.
Oh, that's funny.
A friend of mine's in it. She was a former Charleston comedian as well, but she's in it. And I can't remember the guy who wrote it. He's in a bunch of TV shows now. He's on an ABC show right now. But he wrote this play that was just like sort of like almost kind of like parodies the two movies together with just like an all black cast, and it was really funny. Like they did like two nights here in LA. It was really good.
Damn, I wish I had known about that. Yeah, thanks for mentioning that.
No problem.
Yeah, then he goes into what, like nothing's nerdier than freedom.
Yeah.
Which it took me a few listens to like try to wrap my head around that and like the juxtaposition that he's trying to create there.
Mm-hmm. Like, I think he does a really good job of like explaining like how much has to go into like knowing what the Constitution represents, what went into making the Constitution. Like, there was so many, like, learned men at the time. Like, there wasn't that many, actually. Like, there wasn't a lot of people who could read and write at the time. So it was these guys coming together to, like, try to make this one thing. And, like, actually understanding all that, I think, would make somebody kind of a nerd, you know?
Oh, John Locke was mm-hmm. a big nerd.
Yeah.
John Locke did, like, metaphysics and was super obnoxious with, like, this concept called hylomorphism in philosophy, having to do with Aristotle and Descartes. Oh, no, and Thomas Aquinas and like what they think substance is. And like John Locke talked about that. And that's like super nerdy. Just like me saying that should let you know it's John Locke and like some of the other founding fathers were like super nerds.
There was like a thing at one point during like back in the 17 or 1800s where like it was kind of a thing. Like if you saw a girl that you were into, you would basically hand her your business card and it would just like list off your attributes, like what you were able to conversate in. Like if you were a conversationalist, like could you talk about science and history? What were your physical attributes? Like some guys would be like, I can leap over a man standing. Can wrestle. I am very knowledgeable on these following authors. The rest, not so much. But like you just hand these off, like, hey, see, this is what I'm good. This is almost like their own dating app at the time was literally just handing the card off to ladies that they were interested in.
I'm surprised that was a thing. And also, you seem very knowledgeable about it. And I need to ask you. Upon learning about that, did you consider doing that?
I just thought it was like a really good idea. I didn't ever do that. Probably should have.
I think that's still time.
Cool. So it was like, what did I really have to like really put myself out there with? I was like, I'm in middle school. I still live with my parents, so that's not great. I never understood dating in middle school. I was like, why are we doing this?
Well, I don't think you should say you love your parents. I think you should say, you know, strong family bonds.
Oh, there we go.
Yeah.
Yeah, strong family bonds. It's good.
Dude, I love that you come in with so much trivia, dude. but yeah, he starts to mention all of these black nerds that he later relabels as, you know, just being black leaders.
Mm-hmm.
And like the shift, the nominal shift from black nerd to black leader is such a good, like, how would you describe what happens there in the realization?
He almost like reframes it in a way, because like he's not going for like lowest common denominator kind of thing, you know, where he's like, oh, what about these people? It's weird because like this is like before like any of the Black Lives Matter protests or whatever, you know, so you're not really expecting it, you know, like this is before like everybody was on like. Black Lives Matter, I think, has made a lot of people rethink their thoughts on black people in general, you know, and be like, oh, okay, yeah, black people matter, of course, yeah. And be more diligent about, like, you know, how they talk to people and what they think and do, you know?
Yeah.
But before that, so we have this guy who's, he's not doing a Black Lives Matter thing, but he's just like, hey, do you think, because there are genuinely some people who are like, I don't know, I guess black people got free from slavery and then they're just here still. They haven't really given us much, I'll tell you that, you know, or whatever. And you're like, no, there's plenty of brilliant black people out there that have done some great things for, you know, the country and for civilization as a whole, you know?
Exactly. And then he starts to move into the act out
mm-hmm.
of like, oh, he gives reasons as to why it became unpopular in the 80s.
Right.
For a black man to read, for a black person to read, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, crack and Reagan.
Yeah. But, that's such a weird thing to me. Like, I mean, not weird, but it's just like such a funny thing to me that, like, again, that's one of those things that everybody remembers about the 80s is crack and Reagan. Like, they're
guys. Comedy loves detail. Comedy loves, like, audiences love being in the know.
Mm-hmm.
That's like, if you can flatter someone enough that they understand all of your jokes.
Yeah,
you've got them. You got them out of the palm of your hands.
Yeah.
So then, he starts to do an act out, you know, describing how the pursuit of knowledge became a nerdy thing.
Mm-hmm.
And when I listen to this, not that, you know, the other jokes weren't great, but I'm like, this act out is so important
and
so like worth tuning in for. Because he's kind of doing a critique, you know, like I'm not sure what it was like for you, Andy, but like in like your own cultures, right? You kind of want to critique them in order to better them.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So he takes on the role of someone who we might see around the block who discourages other people from reading or learning or paying attention in class.
Yeah.
And he does it really well by like really shoehorning these long lines of like, you know, well, he sets it up like this. you know, like, what are you reading? The Constitution? This nerd wants to understand the country as a concept envisioned by our forefathers and wants to see if there's a gap between that and how our elected officials, you know, enact it.
Yeah. And, nerd.
Yeah, nerd. Yeah. Nerd. So, we understand. It's like, I love that he, I guess to use the old term, right, highbrow. He's doing kind of like highbrow comedy.
Sure.
But he, even if he's not, even if that's not his intention, let's say he's not trying to do highbrow comedy, that means that he's giving his audience, what's the word? Like the benefit of the doubt, that they understand that they're smart enough. You know, he's not, he thinks that they're a smart audience. That's why he's like, I'm going to comfortably tell this joke.
Yeah. I feel like he's got two things going for him is that, like, he's, like you said, it's kind of a highbrow joke. But he's already got them on his side because he did all the stuff earlier. He did like a lot of heavy lifting at the beginning where he was just like, hey, it's me. I'm crazy bus driver guy. I can't get ladies. I can only get mosquitoes. That's funny, right? Okay. I realize black people have sweet blood. Hey, right? Am I right? Okay, guys. And then he just kind of slips into that Obama thing where it's like, you're already on my side for the last 2.5 minutes. Stick with me for this, you know? And then he's got such a great rhythm to the part you just talked about where he's like, the country as an idea, you know, and et cetera. Like, it has such a like nice, good rhythm to it that he's going to get I feel like he's going to get a laugh even if people don't necessarily completely understand it, you know?
Yeah, that's interesting that you mentioned that. Even if they don't completely understand it, they know that that's when they're supposed to laugh.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're completely right in describing this whole setup. Like, what? Sometimes, you know, people who are in sketch or improv and they or do some other sort of, what's the word, ancillary sort of comedy, who want to do stand-up, and they ask me, like, or they like, mention how difficult it is for them to write stand-up. They always mention that they kind of want to go from nothing to like the most. They kind of want to already talk about these really big issues.
Yeah.
But first, you just have to show the audience that you're funny.
Yeah, big time. I think that's really important. And also, like, even if I agree with the person, if they come up and just say like, "Well, this thing sucks," I'm like, "Can you like start with just like a mention of yourself so we're aware that you're a person and not just like an idea that something sucks."
Yeah. Like talk to the, is one of the things that I learned last in stand-up, right? Because I was like, I'm a one-liner comedian, right? What I'm going to do, waste some time up top, right? Talking about whatever.
Yeah.
But yeah. You have to you have to show that you want to be there, that you know, you're excited in a way.
Yeah. Because even if I agree with you, like you know, people are like, "Oh, Trump sucks." Like that's their first line when they get on stage, and I'm like, "All right, do you suck? Or are you cool? Or
yeah, what about you? Are you just echoing what everybody else is saying?"
Yeah,
yeah. There is a personal aspect that needs to be highlighted in your set. Yeah,
yeah.
Or even this, I think maybe this would be comparable if. Well, okay, you know when you're waiting to do stand-up or whatever, and then, you know, you're part of a show, and then, you know, something weird happens, and it's weird enough that the audience realizes it, and then you go up on stage, and then you point out that weird thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think even that's a comparable way to kind of emerge yourself, or like ingratiate yourself with the audience.
Oh, totally, because you're like, hey, I'm here too. I am also a person. That was crazy.
Yeah.
Like, we can all agree on that, right? Now we're on board with each other.
Yeah, so I think, yeah, that's one of the things you should tell beginning comics, right? It's just like...
Yeah.
Yeah, you might want to be like Bill Hicks later, but first you gotta, find a way to be... You want the audience to like you.
Like, totally.
Don't seek their approval, but you still want them to like you.
No. Yeah. Like, did you watch Ali Wong's, like, her first Netflix special?
No, why?
Oh, it's just she does such a good job of like kind of making fun of herself, tearing herself down, but also being very honest about who she is as a person, because she keeps saying like, All I wanted to do was find a rich husband so I can trap him.
Yeah.
And then just be done with doing anything, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And he keeps going with it, going with it. And there's like this, I don't want to spoil it, but there's a big twist at the end. But she did such a brilliant job that like when that twist hits, you're like, oh my God, what? That's amazing. How did you do that? Like, but she does such a good job just like building who she is as a person that she's able to go off and talk about other things and then come back to herself again. And so you're like, oh, okay, that's cool. You know, it's interesting.
Oh, that's, oh, I'll check that out.
Yeah.
Yeah, it sucks that I haven't. But I will. I will. I promise. You know what, Andy?
You don't have to, man. I'm never going to be one of those people who's like, you have to do this. You're not going to grow as a comedian if you didn't see this thing.
No, that's, you're saying the opposite, but I'm hearing exactly that.
I've still never seen Nanette. So, you know, like, I guess that first.
You know what? You know what I would always recommend to stand-ups? Crowdberry. Todd Berry is a crowd work tour.
Oh yeah, that's really good.
That one's so fun.
Yeah.
But yeah, so let's just get to the last tag on this one. The last little act out.
Oh, sure, sure. Yeah.
Where he set up this whole thing. He gets a big laugh. And it seems like he's gonna end on that laugh. At the end of that act out, but then he goes on to pretend to be a kid who's like, you know, they're, was it them for reading or something?
Yeah.
And then the mother figure consoles the kid, saying, "No, it'll be fine. You'll be, you know, what does he say?
Basically, like, don't you worry about that, Barack.
Barack. Yeah. There we go. Don't you worry about that. Yeah, there you go. And it's icing on the cake.
Yeah, totally.
It's so, because that's such an important tag. You know, he's encouraging kids to read.
Yeah,
he's showing like, if you're a kid who's lucky enough to see that, it might show you the absurdity of someone bullying another one for trying to better their conditions.
Right. And the thing is too, that like, again, this is Baron Vaughn, black Shakespearean actor. So I'm sure he got his fair share of like being made fun of, you know, reading and studying art and stuff like, and plays and theater and stuff like that.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's super important, man.
Yeah.
So I think we've pretty much, I think, hit all the jokes. I think we clearly, I think you actually did this really well, where you mentioned how the early jokes are doing the heavy lifting for this final joke and act out and the tags at the end.
Yeah.
I think it's very straightforward.
Right.
But because it's straightforward, it doesn't mean that it's not incredibly like clever.
Yeah, it's clever. I mean, again, like I think really and truly people, if they're listening to this, they need to go watch the performance as well. Cause like he's doing so much on stage as well to really sell the jokes.
Oh yeah. Sorry. I forgot to mention that. Yeah. Please speak to that.
I mean, he's almost like he's doing little dances and like, when we say act house, it's not like he's just like, I open the store. Like whenever he's like, I present to you the blues, he like holds his hands out like he's gesturing to like the blues as if they were an actual person.
Yeah.
I present to you the blues. And then he like looks over to his right and there's the, you know, as if the blues were actually there, which is so great. And like he is, his cadence changes up. He's able to change his voice a little bit, you know, and stuff like that. And it's so, like, he's obviously like rehearsed this set, but it feels so good to like listen to it. It's like, oh, this is great. It doesn't feel like, what's the word? It doesn't feel redundant. It doesn't feel like he's just saying words. It's like he's fully into the performance that he's going through, you know?
Yeah, it doesn't plateau because he changes up his physicality.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know if you know this. Maybe, I'm sure you do, but like one major criticism or stereotype that improvisers or people who do sketch have against stand-ups is that we don't commit.
Oh, totally.
That we're like about being punchy, right? About getting the joke in, that we won't like, what's the word? Degrade ourselves. Like we won't Like, we won't play a dog on stage, right?
Yeah.
And Baron Vaughn, I think it's mainly because he's, you know, he came from an acting background, but here he challenges that stereotype.
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
I would also I don't know. I know you guys talked about Maria Bamford a couple weeks ago too. And she did that whole fart bit. And I was I feel like she's degrading herself, you know, right there. Like, I don't think it happens enough. I definitely think there's a lot of comics who take themselves way too seriously.
Can you name one?
Say what?
Can you name one so I can tag them in the episode?
Oh, I mean, like, just kidding, how many do I have to go through, you know? So many. Like, there's so many comics. Like, I get it. Whenever I first moved to L.A., it felt to me that, like, most of the L.A. comics, or a lot of the L.A. comics that I met when I first moved here, were all people who, like, had tried to make it in improv and didn't. And so they were super bitter about improv.
You think so? Okay.
That's what I met. I met quite a few when I first moved here. I haven't met that many since, but, like, there was a lot of them who were, like, they were all from Chicago. They'd all done Second City. They're like, oh, yeah, I did that Zip Zap Zop stuff. And I was like, oh, you were really bad, didn't you? And you didn't get it. It did not happen for you. I'm sorry.
Damn. Yeah, I think you have a good point. There is a sort of sense of entitlement.
Yeah.
And, like, given that you don't succeed in LA, I'm happy for you. Like, now, like, knowing that you developed, like, the majority of your comedy over there in Charleston.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Cause, and you can just tell in, like, your attitude towards comedy that you have not succumbed to that jaded attitude that's abundant in Los Angeles.
Yeah. Don't get me wrong, there's times where I'm definitely, like, mad. I'm like, oh, I didn't get that thing that I wanted, kind of. And it's like, well, you didn't, so keep moving.
Yeah.
I feel like you have to have other outlets other than just stand-up, because you will get mad. If that's your only thing that you're going to focus in on, like, yeah, you're going to be real mad about that.
Oh, yeah, that's why I started doing improv. And, like, then I was just – that helped my my psyche when it comes to stand-up, because I'm like, okay, well, if I don't do well here, that's fine. If I'm not good at the guitar today, I'll go play the drums for a bit.
I think my favorite thing in the world is improvisers doing stand-up for the first time.
Okay. Yeah, why?
Because that's always an interesting thing to see them, like, that culture shock for them. I had a friend who was doing it for a little bit. And he leaned over, like, at his second or third mic, I think, we were at. He was like, is this what you do? I was like, what? He was like, you just sit and wait for your turn.
Yeah.
I was like, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Stand-up, it can be a very solitary activity.
It totally is. If I see friends at a mic, I'm like, wow, that's cool. But mostly I'm not expecting to see anybody I know at mics. When I go to mics, I'm just like, whatever, it's fine.
Yeah. I also like how, like, improvisers, they come in with a lot of, like, stage presence, but just where are the punchlines?
Yeah. They're like, what do you guys? I'm like, no, you don't get a word. You have to write some stuff down. Just do it.
Yeah. Hey. I think it's about that time.
About that time. All right.
So, dude, thank you for sharing your insight. I think we've definitely killed that frog.
Oh, definitely.
And please plug, and where can we find you if we wanted to know more about you or whatever, look at your face.
Oh yeah, all right. So I'm on Instagram at the Andy Ryder. I'm actually at Andy Ryder again on Instagram. Sorry, I don't know my own stuff. And at Andy Ryder again on Instagram. I'm part of a web series called Selling In that's still going on. Like, we have a Facebook page called Selling In if you want to watch me do a bad acting job, that's your place to go. But it is a really funny series. There's a lot of funny people on there. I do a show twice weekly on Wednesdays and Saturdays where it's me and my friend, comedian Matthew Robinson, on Instagram, and we just interview other people about their quarantine experiences, and then we have dumb sketches that we do sometimes.
Nice.
Yeah.
Shout out to your co-hosts on all the other shows that you do.
Oh yeah, Sammy Sucker, Chris Jason. We're not doing Best Fest. It's Best Fest Comedy. Whenever the quarantine ends, we'll be glad to do those shows again the third Saturday of every month at Winovino.
Oh, you're over there. Yeah.
Yep.
That's a good little spot.
I love that place. Basement.
Yeah. Nice.
I'm so glad that they have an alternate revenue stream other than just comics buying drinks from them. I'm glad that they have like a wine shop to like continue to make revenue.
Yeah. Also, I would take a date there. If you know, I would recommend it. I mean, maybe on a comedy night and not a comedy night.
Oh yeah, totally. Yeah, just take a date there. My wife and I have gone there and just had like drinks and dinner. You know.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, and you still support the establishment even when they're not providing you with a space for a comedy, dude. Awesome. Yeah. Very cool. Well, Andy, you know, I'm happy to have met you through this interview process. Seemed like a great guy. Thanks for coming on and sharing your insight. And I gotta say bye bye now.
All right. Well, good to see you, or talk to you, anyways.